Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And I want to welcome you again, comrades and friends. This is Siegfried. Once more, things did not work out as planned. I planned on making new episodes of the show on a more regular basis after the long hiatus I took this spring, but as it so often does, life got in the way and I was unable to do that. That being said, I've wanted to make a show about the topic that I'm going to discuss today for quite some time now. It's not an easy subject to discuss. Many of the details are absolutely horrific. But as settlers on stolen native land, we have to see the truth of indigenous genocide and confront its reality. The discovery of the bodies of hundreds of indigenous children beneath the grounds of multiple former residential schools cannot be papered over by the rhetoric and false promises of politicians. Mass murder is a Canadian reality, and Canada Day, July 1st, should be a day of mourning, not a day of celebration. Countries built on genocide should never be celebrated. I mean, if we want a country that we can be proud of, we'll have to vanquish colonialism and start again. That's what we're going to have to do right here. And I'm firmly convinced of this. Earlier this month, I attended the gathering in downtown Guelph to mourn for the 215 indigenous children discovered in unmarked graves on the site of the former Kamloops Indian Residential School in BC. Since then, the grounds of other former residential schools have also been investigated through the use of ground-penetrating radar, and hundreds more bodies have been found. You know, just as survivors have been telling us for decades, you know, this confirms everything. This past Thursday on June 24th, the COESIS First Nation in Saskatchewan reported that between 600 and 751 unmarked children's graves were uncovered at the former Maryvale Residential School. And like the Kamloops School, Maryvale was also run by the Catholic Church in cooperation with the Canadian government between 1886 and 1970. In a statement, the Cowessess First Nation stated that, quote, "Our community is in mourning and our families are in pain. Every one of our Cowessess members has a family member buried there. The pain we are feeling is real." You know, and it's important to remember that this should come as absolutely no surprise. It's important to remember that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, the TRC, in the final report of its investigation into residential schools released in 2015, documented no less than 566 deaths at this school alone, like the Maryvale School, like 566 deaths at that school alone over the course of its 9 decades of operation. And admitted that the true numbers were likely much, much higher. Remember that there were 139 residential schools across Canada created under the Indian Act with the specifically stated intention of destroying Indigenous culture and assimilating children into white society by stealing them away from their families and communities, forbidding them from speaking their own languages, and placing them under some of the cruelest disciplinary regimes imaginable. These were genocidal institutions. Now, the TRC confirmed 6,000 deaths related to the residential school system. But given its magnitude and its longevity, with the last school not closing until 1997, that is almost certainly a gross undercount of the true figure, especially because a lot of the deaths were never documented in the first place. Those were only the deaths that they could find that were documented. And, you know, once again, the survivors tell us that many, many, many people died and they were just, you know, thrown away. And there was no documentation, nothing. Nothing written down. You know, life was very much disposable. Indigenous life was very much disposable at these institutions, these genocidal institutions. And as more and more bodies come to light, we're discovering the truth that the government of Canada and the various churches it collaborated with, you know, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, the United Church, there were others as well, in running these schools, they were not only committing cultural genocide, but physical genocide as well. The residential schools weren't just brainwashing and horrifically abusing Indigenous people. They were killing Indigenous people. They were murdering Indigenous people and doing so on a large scale across many decades. And there is the bitter truth that white Canadian heroes like Tommy Douglas and Pierre Trudeau did nothing to stop this murderous system. Instead, they facilitated it. The values that they promoted, you know, the supposed progressive values that they promoted did not apply to Indigenous people. You know, these people were basically, they were colonizers, just like John A. Macdonald, just like Wilfrid Laurier, just like Robert Borden, just like all of them, right? You know, they played their part in destroying Indigenous communities and Indigenous families, Indigenous lives. And it's important to note that we know the individuals who perpetrated these crimes, you know, who worked in the residential schools, who facilitated it, who did all these things. This is not a mystery. Beginning in 2005, the federal government hired 17 private investigative firms to track down thousands of people guilty of physically and sexually abusing children at residential schools. But they weren't tracked down to face criminal charges, only to see if they would be willing to testify in hearings to determine compensation for residential school survivors. And needless to say, very few of them agreed to do so. As a comrade of mine pointed out, probably a dozen different people who work under Carolyn Bennett, you know, the current Minister of Indigenous and Northern Affairs, have the power to unilaterally acquire and seek and leak, I should say, leak the names of 5,315 already identified residential school abusers contained on a secure server, you know, at the cost of their own jobs, and they just don't. I mean, these people could do the right thing and leak those names, you know, of these people. We know we're engaged in, like, horrific abuse of Indigenous children and murder of Indigenous children. They could leak these names if they wanted to, you know, and it would be the right thing to do even if they had to give up their jobs to do it, but they don't do it. You know, they continue their collaboration with a genocidal system. So all of these abusers are known to the government, and all of them are walking free, despite having been active participants in genocide. You know, like, how's that for a travesty of justice? You know, it's yet it's hardly surprising in the context of a settler colonial society founded on the destruction of Indigenous nations that wants to sweep these crimes under the rug. And has demonstrated that time and time again. You know, they don't want to deal with this. They do not want to really address these crimes. Or take meaningful measures to heal the wounds and change society and make sure this, and bring an end to Indigenous genocide. They don't do it. Instead, they perpetuate that genocide. And, you know, by continuing the genocidal policies, by continuing to oppress Indigenous people, you know, take their land, steal away their kids, you know, nowadays it's in, like, foster kid systems and stuff like that. That's how they do it. But they're still basically tearing families apart. They're still tearing communities apart. They're still, like taking over. They're still, like, running roughshod over Indigenous rights, treaty rights. And, of course, Justin Trudeau's up there doing his usual clown routine, talking endlessly about how he's, you know, committed to truth and reconciliation with Indigenous people, and giving the same false promises and empty rhetoric that he gave during the Wet'suwet'en anti-pipeline protest last year. He's saying the same kind of stuff. He's expressed his, you know, horror and disgust at residential schools without making any firm commitments, you know, when it comes to reparations or really anything. Which is kind of his calling card by this point. You know, he's done this before. This is what he does. You know, he talks, he gets up there and he talks, runs his mouth, and does nothing. You know, in true white Canadian fashion, he's all about deflection. You know, to the point of arguing that Canada owns up to its genocidal past. Unlike China with its Uyghur population in Xinjiang, you know, once again trying to sweep the residential school issue under the rug by shouting, "Look over there." That's basically what he's doing. He's basically saying, look over there. You don't look at us, look over there. And this would be truly laughable if it were not so serious. I mean, this settler colonial country founded on genocide, trying to distract people from its very real, documented, undeniable crimes by pointing to a post-colonial socialist state that even the U.S. State Department's lawyers say cannot be charged with genocide based on the current situation in Xinjiang in accordance with international law. You know, it just doesn't meet the standard of genocide. What's going on in Xinjiang right now? And, you know, and like, I'm sure the thousands and thousands of residential school survivors in Canada and the U.S., you know, because there were plenty of similar institutions down there too, would love to have the wall-to-wall media coverage and attention these handful of Uyghur concentration camp survivors get. You know, like, the many, many, many survivors of the real genocide in Canada that's been documented by multiple royal commissions and official government reports. You know, the TRC alone made 94 recommendations in its 2015 report on residential schools, which the Canadian government has effectively ignored. You know, like these many, many survivors of a real genocide, like, wouldn't it be great if they got that attention as opposed to, like, the, you know, these poster boys and girls for a sham genocide, you know, alleged to in bogus studies by U.S. government-funded hacks like Adrian Zenz, affiliated with the neoconservative Jamestown Foundation and the quasi-fascist Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. That's who's really behind these allegations of genocide in China. And the current genocide allegations against China are not unlike, you know, the comparison needs to be made here. They're not unlike what happened in the 1980s when the Reagan administration promoted the bogus claims of far-right Ukrainians that more people died in the 1933 Holodomor famine than were killed in the Holocaust, which some of those same Ukrainians actually participated in, by the way, including our own Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland's grandfather, who she remains very proud of. So you have settler colonial governments promoting fake genocide narratives about other countries while covering up the real genocides that they commit or are complicit in at home or abroad. You know, even in the face of undeniable evidence, you know, like hundreds of dead children unearthed at these former residential schools, they still try to claim the moral high ground and attempt to point the finger at someone else. And all this after more than a century of policies aimed at crushing Indigenous people politically, economically, and culturally, right? It's the ultimate in cowardice and hypocrisy. But fortunately, people are waking up. You know, hundreds of people showed up to the event that I attended earlier this month, mourning the 215 children found in Kamloops. There are major actions planned for July 1st, including in Guelph. Egerton Ryerson, the founder of Ryerson University in Toronto and one of the key architects of the residential school system, had his statue torn down recently. Thousands of people have stood in solidarity with Indigenous people across the country as they fight for truth and justice, you know, even though there's still a pandemic going on. People are still going into the streets. They're still putting their bodies on the line. And thousands more have agreed to cancel Canada Day, you know, Canada Day, you know, like, I mean, I can't even pronounce the word, and, like, you know, I really don't care, you know, by refusing to celebrate genocide. You know, a shift in consciousness is taking place, you know, not unlike what happened during the Wet'suwet'en solidarity protests last year, only more profound. Because just, like, now it's like, increasingly impossible to look away. I mean, this is, if you believe at all in justice, you know, you have to take a stand now. You can't remain on the fence. I mean, it's harder and harder for people to try to declare neutrality. You know, you have to act, you know, or basically be revealed to be a total hypocrite. You know, but it also needs to be said that anger and tears are not enough. You know, reparations need to be made to residential school survivors and the communities, not only by the government, but also by the churches that ran the schools. You know, surviving perpetrators of abuse at these schools should be tried for their crimes and punished. The Racist Indian Act needs to be torn up. You know, treaties must be respected. The tyranny of child protection services over Indigenous families, which continues to tear Indigenous children away from their communities, must be brought to an immediate end. Serious action must be taken to protect Indigenous women and girls. You know, no more stolen sisters. And Indigenous nations must have genuine self-determination and sovereignty over their lands in the face of capitalist development projects, pipelines, and extractive industry. And of course, those industries need to be challenged. You know, not just the exploitation and and destruction they commit in Canada, but also around the world. And in the end, a new constitutional arrangement must be democratically drafted, voted on, and put into effect to end the mechanisms of colonialism and make this country into a voluntary federation of distinct nations. Voluntary and equal federation of distinct nations. Now, Canada, as we know it, most likely will not survive a process this thorough. The old settler colonial country will have to die, and a new country will have to be built in its place. But if that's what justice demands, then it must be done. Because we can't have it both ways. White Canadians in particular are going to have to make a choice, whether they want colonialism or justice. Indigenous people have made their voices clear. And we must listen to them and decide what it is that we want for ourselves. And I, for one, would like to see those of us of European descent become something better than colonizers and abusers. You know, like we can't keep leaning on BIPOC people to tell us what to do or make all the decisions for us. You know, putting all the burdens on their shoulders, putting it all on them. That's childish. It's childish and it's racist. You know, we have to take responsibility and decide for ourselves what we want to be, what we want to do. What future do we want? No one else can do this for us. And of course, there's a lot of right-wing reactionary forces that want to stunt our growth and keep us tied to colonialism. You know, white people need to stop being good little colonial policemen. White people need to stop being good little colonial conscripts, you know, little soldiers keeping everyone else in line within a racist system. You know, because of the token privileges that it offers to us. You know, we need to reject that. We need to rebel. We need to mutiny. We need to evolve. And if we do this, there's no reason why we can't become some of the world's fiercest fighters against systems of oppression and exploitation. You know, just do a complete 180. And remember, the mutinous soldier is always the Empire's most dangerous foe. Remember 1917. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR, comrades and friends.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me. Jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they palm me. They're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me. Materialists test me. Pollution, it chokes me. Movies, they joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life, it jades me. Hudson Bay fleece me. hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
Come from old Whittington Hill. My people bow their heads down to the lord of the manor still. I grew up mean and hungry, dirty and poor and sick. I tried my best for not to steal, too afraid of the Van Diemen ship. Well, the only road to money, it was the road to the army gates. I took that road in 45 with the gang of my Staffordshire mates. We were shipped across to Ireland, some rebellions fought to quell. Stationed north of Galway in the landscape. We were there to guard the food, being shipped each day to England while the starving they were subdued. They said we needed the food more for our hungry boys abroad, and the Irish apes who found it, they went mad in the eyes of the Lord. My dear friend Billy Cooper, he couldn't console himself. From a cherry tree in the back field, he was hanging by his belt. In the 41st Foot Regiment, just north of Galway town, I felt myself the servant of a devil in a crown. I disobeyed an order, I refused to shoot a man. Now stripped of my gun and uniform, I am bound for Van Diemen's land. You rogues who rule Britannia, may you burn in hell for good. Us poor, we do your dirty work, then you dine on our flesh and blood.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was a couple of songs there. First song we heard was a song by Willie Dunn, Mi'kmaq singer back in the 1960s and 70s. And that song was called I Pity the Country. I've played it many times on this show, and it just did. That song is never going to get old until colonialism is eradicated in this country. That's all I'm going to say about that. The second song was Damien Dempsey with a song called Sam Jenkins. Now, Damien Dempsey is, of course, an Irish singer-songwriter. And that song was about the Irish genocide, you know, the famine genocide that took place in the 1840s, from which my family fled from to come to Canada. Now, and some of you might know from previous shows, one of the things that really breaks my heart is when Irish people and people of Irish descent end up becoming collaborators in settler colonialism in North America and Australia and places like that. And they become part of these colonial systems that originally were oppressing them. And collaborating with Empire and all that. You know, this is one of the things that really breaks my heart. And one of the reasons why I play that song is because there has to be solidarity. You know, and, you know, Irish people in particular, they can look to their own past. And they need to look at that. They need to understand who they are, and they need to throw off the blinders, the whiteness, you know, that the white privilege and white supremacy put over their eyes. They got to get rid of those, and they got to realize who their real friends are and who they need to stand with in this world, and really stand against colonialism and fight against colonialism in all its guises. That's really an imperative thing that people of our background really need to understand. So that's really what I want to say about that, why I played that song. Now, what I want to do now is I want to play a documentary from CBC Radio about residential school survivors. This is testimonies from various residential school survivors. This is from about 3 years ago, this documentary. But it kind of tells you in many ways really what was going on, and gives a pretty good overview. Quotes from various officials who were responsible for setting up the residential school system in the first place, and what their agenda was, their genocidal agenda was, and yeah. So this is called Stolen Children. So I'm gonna play that for you right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I got frightened when I was a little girl when the principal used to beat up the other children, like boys. The boys got the most beating. They used to call it bench party, and it was usually done after supper. And that's where I got frightened, because I saw blood.
I remember when we had to shower. You only have to show me how to shower and clean and wash myself, how to wash my private and my, you know, private parts of your body. You only have to show a kid once or twice at the most, but not every day. You know, and have the supervisor come in there and basically take advantage of you. You know.
I just remember arriving there and donning new clothes and, of course, getting a haircut and sitting in a classroom and being with other girls and witnessing my brother get punched by the supervisor.
My name is Alice Little Deer. I'm 78 years old. I spent about 8 years in residential school.
My name is Raymond Mason. I'm 62 years old, and I attended residential school for 12 years.
I'm Madeline Dion Stout. I'm 62 years old. I'm from the Kehewan First Nation in Alberta. I attended Blue Quills Residential School for 36 consecutive months. That would be 3 years.
In order to educate the children properly, we must separate them from their families. Some people may say that this is hard, but if we want to civilize them, we must do that. A federal cabinet minister, 1883.
I remember them taking me away from my mother and my stepfather. And I can hear them telling my mom that that was the best thing for me. You know, and that not to worry, I would be looked after.
Our parents didn't want to worry us unduly and tell us and warn us that we are going to be separated for a long, long time with barely a visit.
I see him come around, Indian agent in a boat with the principal, then collect some children from the reserve. Mm-hmm. Then he would come back again, come and take some more.
So the next day, I woke up with hundreds of total strangers, my size, my age, and not knowing, you know, what are they doing with all of us here? Why are there so many of us here, you know? And that's where a lot of my whole life really started to change. Because I got strapped, I got beaten up for speaking my own native tongue. I even had my tongue pulled out and pinched, you know.
My strongest memory there is when the little girl died beside me. She must have been about six. I was scared. Why the parents were not there. That's what I was scared about. And I knew they wouldn't feel comfortable for not being there when their daughter's dying.
And do you know why they weren't there?
They were never notified.
Indian children in the residential schools die at a much higher rate than in their villages. But this does not justify a change in the policy of this department, which is geared towards a final solution of our Indian problem. Duncan Campbell Scott, Deputy Superintendent of Indian Affairs.
At that time, they never told us that our sisters were across the hallway. And I didn't know that for the longest time. Then I spotted my sister, Nora, and I was so glad and so hysteric, and I went running to her and I leached onto her, you know, and just hugged her, and I was just shaking, like, you know, and terrified. And I was wondering why she was pushing me away. I didn't realize that we weren't supposed to know that we both lived in the same place, and we weren't allowed to speak to each other, we weren't allowed to talk to each other. And I can remember the principal grabbing a hold of me by the hand, you know, and I was jumping off the floor like that, and he stripped me. And he started whacking me with a long, webbed a strap. He was setting an example that, you know, if you do this, is what's going to happen to you. Like, and all the other boys were watching, and the girls were still going through, you know.
Their education must consist not merely training of the mind, but of a weaning from the habits and feelings of their ancestors and the acquirements of the language, art, and customs of civilized life. Edgerton Ryerson, 1847 Report for Indian Affairs.
Visits from my parents were very rare, but I do recall one visit when my mother and father came, and I remember specifically my mother's red tam, that splash of color. I remember her getting out of the wagon, and I was crying already watching them, because I was missing them already. They hadn't even walked through the door yet of the residential school, but I was missing them already. And when they were actually leaving, I cried until my nose bled.
And you learn pretty quick after getting those kind of beatings. Not strapping, it's literally beatings, you know. And ever since that day, I tried to run away. And I made friends with a guy by the name of Donald Atkinson from Rosa River First Nation. And we planned, you know, to take off. And when we got caught, we paid for dearly, you know. Not only did the RCMP give us a licking, but the boys, that were, the bigger boys that was helping them chase us down.
Were you angry at your parents that they made you go to school?
Sometimes. Sometimes I would think about them, I'd get mad for all giving me here, sending me over there where the, all the bad treatment is. And sad. My first two boys went, and then a couple years after, the next two boys went, and so on as they got older. Yeah, I told them to be strong. I had always told them to be strong, to be able to take it like the other children.
So you sent 11 kids to residential school? Mm-hmm. How many of them do you think were strong through that?
None of them. None of them.
What about your children? How do you think it affected them, being in residential school?
Well, like I said, a little bit crazier. Then before they went to school, their mind was a little bit more intact. Staying at home with us, they knew how to hunt ducks, and they knew how to fish, and they knew how to snare rabbits and pick blueberries. Today you don't see that.
And you think that's the school?
Yeah. Everything destroyed in our world. Mm-hmm. We didn't bother white people. White people bothered me.
Indian culture is a contradiction in terms. They are uncivilized. The aim of education is to destroy the Indian. Nicholas Flood David Report, 1879.
There are three reasons why I think residential schools are a blot on the Canadian landscape. One is that we became strangers in our home and native land. Two is that nurturing relationships between parents and children were severed. Residential schools were a frontal attack on parenthood. Three is that it added to our mental stress in a very real way.
My name is Michael Loft. I'm from Ganawagi. I'm 55 years old, okay, and my dad attended residential school for 11 continuous years in Spanish Ontario. He says, and once he told me a story where they were so bored, they were in the cafeteria, and they would just walk in a circle, you know, because they couldn't just go run around, you know, willy-nilly all over the residential school just because school was out. They had to be controlled, I guess, had to be contained, and so they would walk in circles, you know, in the cafeteria round and round and round and round to deal with their boredom.
My name's Lorena Fontaine. I'm 38 years old, and both my parents and grandparents went to residential school. I was at a conference that my mom was speaking at. She was giving the keynote address, and she started talking about her residential school experience during her speech. And that's how I found out. Well, I was, of course, I was shocked and appalled, and I just felt so terrible for her. I felt frozen when I was listening to her. And it wasn't until after she finished speaking that I started thinking about our family life. I started thinking about the abuse that was very prevalent when I was a child. And I started putting connections together.
He never knew when he was going to get hit in residential school. That's the thing. So it was, he lived like in fear of getting hit. You break a rule, you get whacked, you know. So it was unpredictable, you know. You couldn't, you could try to learn the rules as best as you could, but I mean, you're a kid, you know, and you'd mess up and whack, you know. So there was that unpredictability that he brought home too. And the same thing with us. We didn't know what was going to happen, you know, next. So it was scary.
I was raised by parents who never had a childhood, and they didn't have any parents as role models. So we were vulnerable children. And a lot of us were abused ourselves as young children. And I also realized at that point that one of the people who abused me and my family had been a residential school survivor, a family member. And I understood why now, why I was abused.
The great aim of our legislation has been to do away with the tribal system and to assimilate the Indian people in all respects. Sir John A. Macdonald, May 2nd, 1887.
He got out, you know, like everybody gets out at 16. And he eventually made his way to Aguizasne, to his home. And he told me that he couldn't connect with them. He couldn't connect because he couldn't speak the language. He didn't understand the culture. So he couldn't take it, you know. He was frustrated. He was going nowhere. So he turned him, he went back to the residential school for one more year because it seemed like that was home now. That was home. And that's where he could, you know, they spoke his language. And so that's where he went.
I grew up not knowing my language. And in fact, I kind of felt a bit ashamed about our language and our identity because it seemed like they were, meaning my parents and my aunts and uncles, were ashamed too in some way because they didn't want to talk about it and they didn't want to share with us about who we were.
There was a lot of fear. I think the fear that they put in him, the terror that they put in him, I mean, he managed to bring that with him. I mean, it went into our family, you know. And I learned terror and fear and all that as well as a child. I put fear in my sons too. That's all I knew. You know, when they were doing something that was right, I would put fear in them, you know.
Our objective is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politic, and there is no Indian question and no Indian department. Duncan Campbell Scott, Deputy Superintendent of Indian Affairs, January 1st, 1920.
Generally, the survivors of residential school do not commit suicide any more than the general population. Okay. It's the children of the residential school survivors who commit suicide in incredibly high numbers. You know, 6 to 7 times, you know, the provincial average. Okay.
It might just take one person to start talking about it, or perhaps a family to start talking about the fact that there is abuse, and the reason why there's that abuse is because of the residential school experience. That, you know, we're not abusive people by trade. We're not We weren't born that way. And to be able to, I think families need to be able to realize that they're not alone, that none of us are alone anymore, that we have each other, and that it's okay to start talking about it.
We don't have the monopoly on pain and hurt, but we have and have carried a disproportionate share of it over time. And I would really like us to move forward, not to erase our memory of who we are, because residential school is certainly a part of who we are. I'd like us all to be a part of a team that really makes a lasting difference for not only residential school survivors, but the other little children who are having difficulties today.
Comes the spring, and its warm thaw around your neck, the eagle claw upon your head, the buffalo horn. Today a great new chief is born, so raise him fast towards the sun. Heart now beats, a life's begun. It's 1821. Today a Blackfoot soul is born. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Your years have gone, the years have passed. Your heart is set, your soul is cast. Stand before the council fire. You have the mind and the desire of notions wise. You speak so well, and in brave deeds you do excel. And it's 1853, and you stand the chief of Confederacy. You are the leader, you are the chief. You stand against both liar and thief. They trade, raise whiskey, steal your land, and they're coming in swift like the wind-blown sand. They shoot the buffalo, kill the game, and send their preachers into shame. And it's 1864, and you think of peace, and you think of war. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better. better tomorrow. See the settler in more numbers. He takes whatever he encounters. You see Lasso, all battered, beaten. Wrong and right, they haven't eaten. And as per se, we're much the same. It seems like such a heartless game. And it's 1876, and the enemy's full of those death-dealing tricks. Today the treaty stands on the table. Will you sign it? Are you able? It offers food and protection too. Do you really think they'll hold it true? It offers a reserve. Now, isn't that grand? And in return you see all of your land. And it's 1877, and you know the scales are so uneven. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Buffalo are slaughtered, there's nothing to eat. The government's late again with the meat, and your people are riddled with the white man's disease. And in the summer they're sick, and in the winter they freeze. And sometimes you wonder why you signed that day, but they broke the treaties themselves anyway. And it's 1889, and your Death Star explodes, and then it falls. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. The years have gone, the years have flown. The nation's sins has swiftly grown, but yet for the Indian it's all the same. There's still hardship, there's still a pain, there's still a hardship, there's still a strife. Its bitterness shines like a whetted knife. There's still hypocrisy, and the hate. Was that in the treaties? Is that the fate? We're all unhappy pawns in the government's game. And it's always the Indian gets the blame. It's a problem which money can never lessen. And it's 1967. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? There'll be a better tomorrow. Maybe one day you'll find honesty instead of the usual treachery. Perhaps one day the truth shall prevail, and the warmth of love which it dozen tales of a crowfoot. Why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow.